people out there don't understand, but there is a need for the world to know about this, because the church is hiding and the government's hiding. There is a lot of people that died in those places.
Is on our side, we can commit any crime. We're absolved individually from that crime by believing that we have a higher sanction. And that's the danger of religion, in that it allows people to do that. It allows them to kill without a shred of conscience.
The church knows where our children are buried. 50,000 died.
In Vancouver, British Columbia, I'm Amanda Bellerby. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Imagine for a moment that your young child goes missing and never comes home. Years pass, and one day the person responsible for your child's murder is identified, but this person evades arrest and imprisonment simply by issuing to you an apology. Imagine that this happened on a massive scale to thousands of parents, like you, across the country. The federal government, while protecting the murderers, orchestrates phony, nationwide truth and reconciliation events where the death of your child cannot be mentioned. The government offers you $10,000 in hush money, which comes with a gag order that says you can't talk to the media or anyone else about any of it. Now imagine that you're one of the children. You're 6 years old and you're torn from the arms of your sobbing mother by armed thugs, who also happen to be the federal police. They take you away to a prison called a residential school, where you stay for the next 10 years. At school, your language is banned, your culture is called evil, and you and all the other child prisoners are regularly humiliated, beaten, sexually abused, and raped by the adults controlling you. In fact, more than half of your fellow students never even make it out of there alive. They're left to die when they get sick, and no doctor or nurse ever comes to help them. Some of the healthy kids get taken to a hospital where they're experimented on, sterilized, and given traumatizing shock treatments. Some of them never come back. Now imagine that the people doing all of this to you are Christian ministers, priests, and nuns from the Catholic, Anglican, and United Churches of Canada, and that the federal government passed a law to make it all happen. Kevin Annett is a community educator and minister in the downtown Eastside neighborhood of Vancouver, BC. He's the author of Hidden from History, The Canadian Holocaust, and he's also made an astounding award-winning documentary film called Unrepentant, Kevin Annett and Canada's Genocide. He joins me here in the Co-op Radio Studios in downtown Vancouver. Kevin, welcome to Flashpoints and Pacifica Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with the residential schools themselves and how they were created. Can you talk about the Indian Act?
Well, yeah, the Indian Act was brought in Canada in 1874. Native people were actually segregated into a different class of citizenship. So they're actually called the legal wards of the state. And that's still the case in Canada. That's never changed. So if you're a Native person under the Indian Act, it means that you can't act on your own behalf. You're in the same category as if you're a mentally incompetent person or a child. So you can't own property, you can't open a bank account, you can't appear in court on your own behalf. And on the basis of that, basically the government and the churches were able to do whatever they wanted to people legally. Even though they've, as you mentioned, tortured and killed people, they can still define for them what would healing be, what would justice be.
So how did these residential schools get set up, and how was it that parents had to let their children go into these schools?
Well, it was operating all through the 1800s. The Catholic Church especially had these mission schools where they would bring in Native kids and, quote, make them good Christians. And what happened in around 1890 is the Canadian government stepped in and authorized the creation of these schools. So they had government money backing them and legitimacy. All of the churches were involved, all the main Catholic and Protestant churches. So we're talking Anglican, that'd be like the Episcopalian Church in the U.S., the United Methodist Presbyterian Catholics, they're all running it. What it was a model that the Catholic Church had used for centuries all over the world, where they went in, they identified the chiefs who could be converted, and they used those chiefs against their own people. And there's stories right here in Vancouver of Chief Capilano, who's a traditional Squamish chief, describes how in the 1920s, the RCMP and the priest went into the longhouse and threw his grandfather out into the snow one night, literally. And they moved in a Catholic native chief. And to this day, the chiefs on the Squamish Reserve are the descendants of the ones that they had parachuted in. So they displaced the traditional chiefs, the clan mothers, and their whole traditional way of thinking and acting and their laws, and they brought in Christian Indians. And that was used as the model for what they did in the residential schools. So in effect, these were like theocratic dictatorships under the control of a priest with government sanction. And basically, the churches had absolute carte blanche to do whatever they wanted. The churches were made the legal guardians of these kids in the 1930s. So the native parent had to sign away guardianship rights of their own kids to the church, to the principal of the school. You know, the Indian agent would come around maybe once a year, maybe a couple of times a year. But I've found letters even where Indian agents describe how they had to look the other way when children died. This was run by the church, and they didn't want to, you know, upset the church by looking too deeply into this. So it was officially a jointly run system, but in practice it was completely dominated by the churches, and the principals were invariably clergymen. That's a bit different than what you had in the States. The boarding schools there tended to be run by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and there were some missionaries involved, but they didn't have the kind of power that the churches have and had in Canada.
You say in the film, when God is on our side, we can commit any crime. Can you talk more about that?
Well, it kind of harkens back to what I mentioned about the attitude. It doesn't just start with the Indian Act. It goes back into the whole history of Christianity, or what some call Christendom. The church has the power and the right to conquer anybody in the world who isn't a Christian. And with that attitude of religious imperialism, if you like, anything can be justified. You know, I was raised on the prairies, and I was raised with the attitude, well, the Indians aren't around anymore. They were here once, but they're just not here anymore. And I remember going out to the Calgary Stampede when I was a little kid, and I saw these native guys, and they had cowboy hats on. I said, Mom, those are Indians. And she said, no, they're not. The attitude is, well, they aren't there anymore. They're kind of assimilated in us, and yet you never have one over to dinner. You never, you know, allow your daughter to marry one.
How many kids were affected or sent into these schools?
Well, the government claims 125,000, but that's a very conservative figure, because that is assuming that the children that were brought in were between the ages of 7 and 16, which is what the law required. In fact, from eyewitnesses, we know that the Mounties, the RCMP, would go into villages and just clean them out of all the children, some as young as 2 and 3.
RCMP is the Federal Police Force.
Yeah, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. So you easily have to double that number. I think that we're talking at least 250,000 children. And their own figures show that half of these kids weren't coming back. So we're talking in the tens of thousands of children who died.
And when did they finally shut down?
Well, the last one actually didn't close till 1996. And a lot of them closed in the 1970s. There's people alive my age, even in their 40s, who were in a residential school. In 1 week here, you probably will have 4 or 5 people committing suicide. You'll probably have twice the number of that dying on the street from fights, being beaten to death by police. That happens regularly. You know, this happens not only in Vancouver, but all over the place. Every one of those people, their problems can be traced directly to what went on in the residential school or what happened to their parents and was passed down. You know, as you described so well at the beginning, you had your entire life uprooted as a child in these schools. There's a man down here, Harry Wilson, who was actually in our film. And Harry talked about how they never used painkiller on his teeth. You know, the dentist would come in and just drill on the kids. And a man had told me that occurred to him 20 years before in the same school. So this isn't just some random act of some sadistic guy. This is almost a policy they adopted of how you traumatize people. All of their heads shaved, systematically raped, every single one of them. You know, the use of means to so traumatize the people that they'll do whatever you want. And, you know, clearly when you look at how this happened historically and why, it was part of a whole plan, especially here in the West, to depopulate the area quickly and get the lands and resources in one generation. The RCMP were actually created, when you look at their mandate, their mandate was to clear all Native people within 50 miles of the railway. So it shows you kind of the attitude is, these people are expendable. They always have been and they still are, but it's an unofficial kind of apartheid.
Let's talk about you, because the way I really want to dive into this reality is through your story, Kevin Annett. I mean, it's a remarkable story. You're very well positioned to be taking on this fight for the people.
Well, like I say, in the 1980s, I was working down here on Hastings Street, out of a United Church, just a block from here, really. And I began to encounter a lot of these problems. Like any non-Native person in the society, I was completely ignorant about the history that had led to this. It's like the whole population is terrorized, and so no one wanted to talk about these things. So after I was ordained, I went to Port Alberni in 1992. And the first time I heard about it, and I describe this in the film, I had gone out to a man's house, Danny Gus, who is a retired native fisherman. And after I had performed a wedding service there, I asked him why there were no native people in the church, because I'd only been in Port Alberni a month. I got up in the pulpit every Sunday and looked out, and there was this lily white congregation in an area that was one third native. I knew that the United Church had had some relationship with the native people. I didn't know anything about the residential schools. So I just asked Danny why they weren't in church. And he looked at me, you know, like almost insulted. And then he was looking out the window at the old residential school, and he said, "My best friend's buried in the hill out there because they killed him in the school, and church people know about it and they don't want us there." And I invited people to get up on Sundays and just tell their stories, which caused quite a interesting reaction among some of the older white people who would get up and stalk out, because these people were related to the ones who would run the residential school, the old missionary families and that. That, and also having to do a lot of funerals of young native people, a lot of teenage suicides, started asking people, you know, where is this coming from? Because it's such a huge phenomenon in the native world. And invariably it was traced back to the fact that their parents, who had gone through the residential schools, didn't know how to be a parent. They didn't know how to love. All they knew how to do was how to hit and abuse their own kids, because that's what had happened to them. When you take away people's identity and their land and their language, and take away their family and the love from there, what do you have left? There's nothing left.
My name's Harry Wilson. I went to Port Alberni Residential School 1959 to 1970.
My name's Kenny Quittell.
My name is Virginia Baptiste. I'm from the Osoyoos Indian Band in Oliver, B.C. I went to the residential school. My first year was 1955. I went until 1963.
My name is Harry Lucas. I'm actually 64 years old.
My name is Nung Kaithka. I come from the people of Haida Gwaii.
At age 5, I was kidnapped by terrorists in a gunboat. The RCMP had this boat with a gun mounted on it to gather children from villages.
Everything that I had had a number. It was 54 on there. And if you were caught with somebody else's number, you got whipped for that.
She was standing at the top of the stairs, and he kicked her. She went rolling downstairs. She was laying like this. Her eyes were open, but she wasn't moving. She wasn't crying.
Her name was Maggie. She was 2 years older than me. And she was murdered in there by a nun. She pushed out the window, second story up, and she died. But nothing was done about it. We weren't allowed to see a lawyer or nothing. They just covered this up.
So I gradually began to learn these things, and when I eventually, the church and I parted company, I began to learn even more.
Talk about the first warning signs that you had that all was not going to be well within the church as you started finding these things out and giving people a platform, giving them a place to speak their truth.
Well, it actually happened about 6 months after I started inviting Native people in. I tripled the size of my congregation. We had really opened up the church to the community. And Fred Bishop, who he's deceased now, he was the chair of my board, and he used to work for the big logging company there, McMillan Bloedel. He came in and had kind of a paternalistic talk with me one day, and he said, "You know, Kevin, you better stick to just being a minister, because you're getting involved in some things that are way over your head. You don't really understand the Native people, and I'd be very careful if I were you." What eventually sealed my fate was I found out that the United Church had for a long time been selling off land that they had basically stolen from the various Native tribes, selling it off to various logging companies that were financially contributing to the church, including McMillan Bloedel, which was eventually bought up by this big American multinational, Weyerhaeuser. In fact, it's the biggest logging company in the world. Weyerhaeuser had manipulated this whole thing because they wanted to get into the last of the old-growth cedar trees on Vancouver Island, and the only way they could do that under the NAFTA agreement was not through the Canadian government, but through the Native chiefs. And the Native chiefs got together with the United Church and did a deal where they handed over this land. The United Church policy on Native land claims was we are to return any Native land in our possession to that Native nation. Instead, they flipped it in a little deal to a local businessman who was connected to McMillan Bloedel. And McMillan Bloedel eventually acquired it very cheaply, about $3 million, and they eventually sold it for $75 million. Now, I wrote a letter about that to the church saying kind of naively, "Hey, wait a minute, we're not supposed to do this." And within a week, church began to hold secret meetings with my board to have me removed, and that happened soon after that.
At the time of Kevin's firing, his church was filled to capacity on Sunday mornings, and Kevin had just received a vote of approval for his work and ministry by 90% of his congregation.
I had no idea that it would blow up in my life to the extent that it did. I was a total innocent walking into a minefield. You know, I thought, okay, the worst that could come out of this is they'll reprimand me and remove me and send me to another church. That's how you deal with a minister who doesn't fit. But I knew in the power politics of the church, it's always a minority who hold the power. And these people who were the old guard, who were connected with the people who had run the residential school, who were scared of Indians, who had the guilty conscience, those were the ones who had the ear of the higher-ups in the church. And I knew they were going to remove me. They didn't want me. It was kind of like, the Matrix when the plugs start flying out of Neo, right? Like the system looks at him and go, whoa, he's not going to fit. Flush. And they flushed me.
How did they end up with the land in the first place?
Well, it kind of goes back 500 years when the Pope passes a thing called the Intercaterra Bull in 1493. It divides the world between Spain and Portugal, and it says any Christian king has the legal right and obligation to dispossess non-Christian people of their land. They called them Saracens and Pagans, but it meant anyone who wasn't a Christian. Those laws were passed by monarchs all over Europe. If you're a Christian, you have superior rights over non-Christians, and non-Christians in North America, on Turtle Island here, Native people didn't own the land. These were legal decisions time and again. Native people don't have the right to sell their land because it's not theirs. They occupy it, but title belongs to the invader. What's called the Crown, the British Crown, the government, owns all the land. So a Native person on reserve is administering the land on the behalf of the government. It's not actually their land. So on that basis, the government came in and said, okay, the Crown owns all this land, and we're going to give it to various churches that set up missions. All you had to do is send a missionary into the bush, sets up his tent, and he's automatically given 400 or 500 acres of land all around there. And so they would often pitch their tent on a very wealthy area with a lot of resources, you know, in the fishing grounds. And this is eventually where the residential schools were built. So it was a mutual theft. The government claimed the land, gave it to the church, and then, as I found out, the church would profit from the various resource companies that were backing them. And they fired me soon after that without cause, and required that I take a psychiatric exam if I was to remain as a minister, and had to go through a year of what they call pastoral retraining. I think in China they call it re-education. But this was very hard on us, because at the time I was married. I had two daughters, 6 and 2, which I saw pretty much as an attempt to scapegoat me, to make it look like that I had had this problem. None of these claims about stolen lands or children being killed in the residential school. You know, it was all kind of the result of this bad minister, Kevin. And in fact, that's still what the church says to this day, that it's an issue about me rather than all of this evidence of the crimes that they committed and their employees did.
Now, in this delisting or defrocking, what was that process like?
Well, it was a nightmare. I mean, it was a culmination of a whole campaign by the church to really try to marginalize and destroy me. And I don't mean that word lightly. Soon after I lost my job, and this came out in the divorce trial, where my wife, Anne, at the time, she eventually divorced me, because the church had gone to her and said to her that Kevin's never going to work again in this country, and we're going to make sure that they offered to pay for her divorce if she would provide them with information. And she did that, and she eventually got custody of the kids. There's a big agenda here that they're not talking about. If they're going to go to that extent and spend $250,000 to throw one minister out of the church.
Is that what it cost?
Over $250,000. Actually, mine was the only public defrocking of a minister in United Church history. It was done in a way, I mean, to give you an example of how ludicrous it was, the lawyer, he's a church lawyer named John Jessamine, he had engineered my firing. He then turns around and is the judge at my appeal and at my defrocking. The panel of three members who would decide whether I'd remain as a minister was hand-picked by Brian Thorpe, who was the other man who had me removed, and then he was called as a witness against me. So it's kind of like, I tell this to lawyers and they go, what? I mean, can churches do this? I had no legal representation.
And there were no charges against you.
Exactly. On two occasions they said in writing, and at the first day, there are no charges against you. We are simply trying to establish whether you're a competent minister. Nevertheless, whenever we tried to raise anything related to my ministry, if it had to do with Native people, if it had to do with the sale of land or the residential schools, it was ruled as inadmissible, right?
How convenient.
Yeah, totally convenient.
The purpose of the hearing was a total railroading and a processing to get somebody who had far too much information for his own good out of there. He'd stepped on big toes. He'd stepped on moneyed toes. It was terrible. At moments, I really wondered if I were in Guatemala or Mexico rather than this quiet late summer afternoon in this church in downtown Vancouver. I couldn't believe the things I was hearing.
I feel it will remain a very black mark against the United Church of Canada. It was a very disgusting type of a procedure. I would call it a witch hunt. A question in my mind as to why a church would be carrying out such an activity. Why they would be spending the money. Reverend Annett was someone who had the trust of the natives, of those underprivileged. And it seemed to me that the church should have been making use of him.
The charges never even got made up. The first I saw of them was late March with a letter that came out in the Courier where suddenly I saw charges listed against Kevin Annett. I mean, this is the kind of nonsense that went on, but very dangerous and very hurtful nonsense.
People who I counted on who would stand by me, they all ran for the hills. I mean, people in the churches, I was pretty much ostracized. And I, you know, speaking of South African apartheid, it's like being a banned person. That's basically the situation I'm in. The media won't cover my stuff. There's all this story out there about how Kevin Annett is crazy and trying to bring down the church and blah, blah, blah. That's so that the people in the wider society never have to look at what I'm talking about, look at the evidence, because it's a way of keeping that evidence delegitimated. You know, it works.
I can't believe what went on there. I think that Jack Bell said it all. He just couldn't stand to watch it. It was obvious that you had stepped on some pretty big toes and that you were going to be slaughtered for it.
That same year, I was actually tossed out of the church. The first of the healing circles were formed here in the downtown east side of residential school people who were suing the United Church. And they knew, actually, my trust level went way up among Native people because I wasn't part of the church anymore. So they began to invite me into these healing circles, asked me to record their stories. And that's how, you know, the process that led to my book and the film actually began about 12 years ago now.
3 years it took me to realize it, though, you know, of torture and pain. You know, I lost my childhood when I first got there and never knew what it was like to have parents. Still hurts. Sorry about that.
It's all right, you don't have to apologize.
I never knew my mother, and still don't today.
It was always hard for us to tell one another we love you. Because we were taught to love was wrong. They told us to love was wrong, that was the devil's work. But yet, these priests and nuns could hug and kiss. And we couldn't even hug our own brothers. We couldn't even hold them and tell them we loved them. It took me a lot of years before I was able to tell my boys I loved them.
I couldn't remember any good times that were there. Uh-huh. Because I was being punished for things I'd never done.
Like what kind of punishment?
Punishment by restraining me to the bed. I had bed problems as wetting the bed. And they would tie me in bed and put an electric underneath my sheet so that when I did wet, I would electrocute myself.
Did they put you in a hospital?
Yes, I did. Well, they gave me some drugs or something like that.
What happened to you when they gave you the drugs?
Put me in there like a padded room, like. I was strapped down.
That was after you reported the girl?
Yeah.
Finding the girl's body?
Yeah.
I'd seen them burn hands of kids when they're 3 years old and five, with a little spike in their hand and like that, like a shock.
Electric shock?
Yeah.
Device? Why did they shock the kids?
Because the kids wouldn't listen to the Catholic priest.
He used it on my brother's penis. He electrocuted his penis there till my brother passed out. And he was laughing, brother. My brother said he was laughing while he was doing it. You'd like to see him in pain, I guess.
And then the police force, I was involved in a few investigations regarding the victims of a residential school where one particular individual had went home in the summer and learned how to speak his own language and His dad had taught him how to carve. When we went back to school, he continued doing this, speaking his own language and carving. And the teacher caught him and took his knife away and broke his carving up. And he took a pencil and he drove it right through his hand. And you still see the scar where he drove the pencil right through his hand.
Then there was other times where they put us in a tub, and then they had a bucket of snakes, you know, them black and yellow snakes. And they'd throw that in the tub while we're having a bath. And the snakes are, they can't stand that hot water. They try and crawl all over our bodies, trying to get away from that hot water. And they'd all just curl up because they'd die immediately. And that was some of the horrifying things that they'd done to us to discipline us to keep quiet.
In Port Alberni, the church hierarchy was lined up with the logging company and the white settlers, if you like. They were continually saying, don't believe these stories. They're making it up. They just hate us because we took away their land. I was told that at every level of the church that all of these stories are lies, not some of them, but all of them. And that got me wondering, too, the fact that the church would have a defensive reaction like that. When they began to get sued, then the church began to talk about apologies and reconciliation. Well, naturally, because they were afraid of losing their shirt in court.
Tell us just a few of the sorts of stories that you heard from the Native people that came into your church.
Well, one story I remember that really struck me was a woman got up once in church, and I don't know how she found the courage to do that, but she actually named a very prominent man, white man in town, as somebody who had, as a teacher in the residential school, been regularly sodomizing the boys and raping the girls, but he especially went after the boys. He would line them all up, and she said it was like a slave auction. They would be lined up outside, and he'd bring his friends in, and they'd all pick a boy and go off with him. She saw him tie a boy to the end of the bed and sodomize him to death, so he died. And then he was buried in the hill out back. And she saw it. She witnessed it for several hours, that happening. And then she was threatened that the same thing would happen to her little brother if she ever told about it. And when she told that, it's kind of like people then have to make a choice. Are you willing to believe that? Because if so, your whole world is going to change. Your whole world is going to end, if you like, because mine did. You have to question, well, how could this be allowed to happen? These aren't random acts. This is being officially engineered and approved from the highest levels of power. And when you hear the stories, you realize this is a tip of a huge iceberg. And the question is, are you going to go down and look at it? Or are you going to just kind of go on the surface and pretend that things are fine, you know, the way you were raised to think of your society?
And that's the voice of Kevin Annett. He is a community minister here on the east side of downtown Vancouver. And we're talking about genocide in the residential school system in Canada.
And I realized with them that all we were doing is sitting around hearing everybody's sad stories, and it wasn't going anywhere. The people were not recovering from this. There were a lot of lawyers and native politicians making money off their pain, but they weren't changing anything in their life. I'd know people who'd tell their story and then go kill themselves. People don't heal from this. That's the reality. The first thing to realize is that I'm never going to get over this, because it's not only so traumatic, but it's so systematic in the culture. You can't heal as a Native person. The whole society is arranged against you. What you can do is to tell the truth. So I knew that, like with the Native people, I was never going to get over this. But what I could do, just like them, I could tell the truth. And that was our power. We got to do more than just talk about our pain. We got to ask the bigger question, why did it happen and who did it? So we said the way to do this is to hold a big inquiry. And that's what happened in the summer of 1998 in Vancouver.
I organized a lot of the survivors to come and give testimony at this. And at that tribunal, anything you could ever imagine that went on in a Nazi death camp was described.
I'm 100% sure that we're used as guinea pigs in these local hospitals for some unknown reason. We're lugged off the hospital, I can remember that. And I know it wasn't for dentistry, I know I wasn't sick.
They had put needles in my head and had hooked them up electrically and would zap me. My arms were put in a chair and locked in, so I couldn't move, and my head was put on a brace in the back, so I could not, I was like this, I couldn't move. I can't tell you how long they had done it. All I remember is that I still, to this day, I still get up, you know, like my brain will still have that kind of a kick from it. They had done a lot of a lot of bad things by putting medications in the food while I was in the dark room, bringing the food in, and you had to eat it. And if you didn't eat it, then if you threw it up into a bag, they put it on the plate again and make you eat it.
I also went to the tribunal that was held. And although I've been with Amnesty since 1961, I had to walk out of that tribunal as the sobbing went on around me and the gulping for air and the crying of the natives as they told their stories. And I couldn't imagine, you know, Canadian men, policemen, fathers and grandfathers going in and taking children out of the arms of native parents and putting them on a gunboat. That all came out at that tribunal. I thought, my goodness, how could they take little 5 and 6 year olds? And as a grandparent myself with a little 5 year old, how dependent he is on family. How could they take those children to these schools where at best they were treated with indifference, but as we know, so much worse went on there.
We've had Chief Harry Nice, we've had Chief Joe Gosnell, we've had Chief Ernie Cray sitting in this room with tears in their eyes describing it to me themselves on television. Mm-hmm. I mean, it happened. We know it happened, and it happened in our lifetime, right?
That's
right. It's not 150 years ago.
I mean, other things were described, the sterilization hospitals. Women showed up who described being sterilized simply because they were Indians and wouldn't go to church.
I couldn't have any more children after Dr. Darby got to me. He made an announcement in our village that anyone who wasn't in church on Sunday had to report to him for a special procedure. I never went to his United Church since they did so much harm. But Darby was missionary, so his word was law. So the Mounties came and got me and brought me to Darby. He gave me a shot. Next thing I knew, I was in bed, all bruised and hurting. I was missing all my gold teeth. Something didn't feel right inside me. I never could conceive after that. Later, another doctor told me I'd been sterilized. George Darby, he did that to hundreds of our women.
Your research also turned up some documents, Dr. Peter Bryce talking about the official mortality rates. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, that's another thing that came out of the tribunal for the first time. I found these documents. Peter Bryce was a medical officer for Indian Affairs back in Ontario. There was a guy, Duncan Campbell Scott, who was head of Indian Affairs, and there had been a lot of criticisms over the years about the health conditions in the residential schools. So he sent out this Dr. Bryce as kind of, to do the typical whitewash government report on what had happened. And Peter Bryce was kind of a unique civil servant because he put his ethics before his pension. He told the truth. He said that what he found was that there was a regular practice in every residential school he had been through in the West, regular practice of housing children indiscriminately, healthy and sick together, and never treating them, which accounted for a death rate of between 30% and 60%.
Sick with what?
Tuberculosis primarily, but other communicable diseases. Time and again, he described how they were not treated, they were left to die, that the reports of their death were fudged deliberately by the church, and the evidence was suppressed. And he said this was a regular practice of the employees. And I remember in one of the letters he asked, how could this happen on such a wide scale unless it was officially sanctioned in some way? His report got buried. He was forced out of the civil service. He eventually wrote a little book about it in 1922 called A National Crime. But he was marginalized in the same way they very much tried to marginalize me and discredit him. 40 years later, the head of Indian Affairs still made reference to half the children dying every year. And this is something even the Globe and Mail in Canada reported recently.
That's the national newspaper.
That's right. Actually, last year in April, there was an article called Natives Died in Droves, despite warnings to government. And they confirmed that the death rate of around 50% stayed constant over 40 years. Right now, the government and their various court scholars are lined up to kind of say, well, none of this was intentional. Yes, children died, but it wasn't intended. Well, then they have to answer a simple question. If it was not intentional, how come a death rate would stay that high over 40 years? And that is a damning piece of evidence that nobody wants to address in Canada.
And certainly the story goes back even farther, both in Canada and the United States, with smallpox. Talk a little bit about Geoffrey Amherst.
Well, he was a British general. He was engaged in a war with the various tribes that were allied with the French in eastern Canada, including the Mi'kmaqs. And he kept a journal which has been published by the Mi'kmaq Nation in Nova Scotia. And he describes how a Major Bouquet, who was his assistant, was to take blankets out of the hospital where their people had been suffering from smallpox and take it out among the Mi'kmaqs to wipe out the, I think the quote was, to extirpate this execrable race. And here in Vancouver Island, you have a lot of stories of the same thing happening among British sailors dropping off blankets outside the villages. We know that statistically in one village called Clouse, in 1860, there was 3,400 people there. And a generation later, there's 44. And that's germ warfare. That happened all over the coast. The residential schools were set up as a way to kind of finish them off and so alienate the next generation from their parents that they wouldn't be able to function as a people and they would not be able to fight for their land. And that's, in fact, what's happened.
This is the grave of Harry Gallaud. And for me, he's the epitome of the problem. You notice his grave has been desecrated. He was an Anglican missionary. He worked for the government as well as the Indian agent. And he also worked for the local timber company. He was like church, state, and company all rolled into one. And he was the man who brought in the local residential schools, who made sure that the children were all imprisoned in the school. He is single-handedly responsible for a lot of the misery around here in the native world. So I'm not surprised that somebody desecrated the grave. This cross is a symbol of all the suffering these people have gone through.
What other price has been paid by the native people amongst each other? Because you were saying earlier that there were collaborators and then those who were not favored. How does that still manifest today in your work? Because are there not native people that are working against you right now?
Very much. As a matter of fact, I would say the main impediment to a lot of this truth getting out has been the state-funded native politicians. And they have been the main ones coming in and saying, it's not true. Children didn't die to this extent. We're in good relationships with the government. We accept their apology. We accept their $10,000 per person, these measly crumbs they tossed to the survivors. Their main body is called the Assembly of First Nations. It was created by the federal government. And, you know, the British Empire did this all over the world. They did it in where my people are from, in Ireland. The Nazis did it in Europe when they set up the Judenrat, the Jewish Elders Council that would administer the Jewish ghettos on behalf of the Nazis. There's a woman, Harriet Nahani, who went to the Alberni Residential School. She said the first day she got to the school, they were all lined up on the beach and their heads were all shaven. And she looked over and there was a group of boys on the side and they were dressed and really well fed. And she turned to her friend and tried to speak in her language. And one boy came over and whacked her on the side of the head. And it was a boy from her own village who had been there a year. And they had trained him. Now, Harriet and the others described they never went to school. They got maybe an hour of schooling a week. The rest of the time, they're working in kitchens. They were farmed out to local white families. The ones who got the education and the better treatment were the collaborators. They're called the enforcers by people down here on the street. And these are the kids who then went on to get the university education. They're the tribal council leaders, invariably. Well, they knew from a young age what they had to do to survive, and they're still doing it. They were cultivated that way. It's not even that the individuals are the problem. It's the system set up of divide and conquer and then cultivating a class of people that are going to, if you like, administer the genocide on behalf of the government for them. And that genocide you can just see right down here on the street. I mean, Native people die at a rate 15 to 20 times the national average. It was set up deliberately that way because, you know, when it comes time to sign treaties, to sign away their lands and resources to the different companies, guess who does it? It's those chiefs, the same ones that are speaking out against the work I do. And, you know, for having a full disclosure of what happened in the residential schools, because if that ever came out, they'd be implicated too.
You've recently done quite a lot of work in the media here in Canada. Start, if you would, with the locations of the grave sites.
Well, in April, I released a list of 28 mass graves near the former residential schools and the hospitals, these Indian hospitals where they're doing a lot of the experimentations and sterilizations and that. And this was based on really 12 years of research and other information that we'd recently gathered about where these children are buried. And we released this to the press, and it's interesting because in the weeks before that, we'd been holding, as we have been for a number of years, been holding vigils and protests outside the different churches. And we had actually issued a letter of demand to the Pope, to the Queen of England, to the heads of all the churches, saying, look, we need you to identify where these children are buried, because the most basic thing we should be doing is bringing them home for a proper burial. None of them, of course, responded. The media were all over us when we were doing that. Suddenly, I released this list of the mass graves. Nobody came to the press conference.
Why?
The third missing piece here. You know, we've got the documentation, we've got the eyewitness stories, but the forensic evidence is what's needed. And we know where it is. We know where the mass graves are. We've even had surveys done with ground-penetrating radar showing that there's burial sites, there's remains of people there. There's a place right here in east of Vancouver called Mission. It was the oldest residential school in British Columbia. It was run by the Catholic Church. Some of the elders there talk openly about there being a huge mass grave that goes back over 100 years, where they were stacking children, four or five bodies, to a grave. So what we've been trying to do is get the native elders to simply give their authority on their land to say, we authorize these digs. And that's in the process of happening. I would say by the end of the summer, you're going to see these graves exposed and the remains brought home so the children can get a proper burial, but also analysis done to see the cause of death. And then we'll have the third missing piece, and we'll be able to issue a definitive report of what actually went on.
How is the church actively suppressing the way the media treats the issues?
The most basic way the church does it is they have a very clear smear campaign on this whole issue and on me. And so they've conditioned a lot of the editors and other people across the country to associate my name with somebody who is not legitimate. They don't produce any evidence about that, but they kind of rely on this Euro-Canadian attitude of, well, this couldn't have happened. Bad things happened, but it wasn't intentional, and we've apologized, and we want to have healing. And that Kevin Annett is disrupting that by talking about deaths and everything, as if I'm the one talking about it, when in fact it's the eyewitnesses talking about it. But they kind of shifted in that way to make it look like it's my issue, rather than it being the issue of thousands of people who they don't acknowledge. Another way they do it, of course, is just by the fact that the media is monopolized in Canada, and there's a group called CanWest that controls over half the newspapers. And it's controlled by the Asper family in Winnipeg, who are longtime backers of the government and are extremely hostile to any discussion of Native rights or anything.
Not an unfamiliar media landscape to Americans.
When we hold vigils or protests, literally every person coming by says, I didn't know this. This is amazing. You know, what can I do to help? So in fact, I find most of the people in Canada do support this and would support a real inquiry. In response to our film coming out, within about a month of it being released in Parliament, the Minister of Indian Affairs gets up and starts saying, we've heard rumors and, you know, statements about children dying in residential schools, and we're going to get to the bottom of this. So they set up this thing called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and they kept comparing it to what went on in South Africa. But from the very beginning, this TRC, which I'll call it, was set up by the government and the churches themselves. The heads of the churches actually chose the three TRC commissioners. So it's the institutions that caused the crime that are setting up the investigation. You know, I often say it's like the serial killer putting their friends and family on the jury. The TRC, and this is on their website, their own mandate says they will have no power to subpoena. They're relying on the voluntary compliance of the churches, you know, to disclose things. And if you're a lawyer for the United Church, how much are you going to let them disclose about children dying? They can't name names, right? So it's all designed to not only protect perpetrators, but make sure that these stories are controlled by the government and the churches. To even compare it to South Africa is ridiculous. And this was a quote from Bob Watts, Native politician on the government payroll, who was set up as the Native window dressing on the TRC. He said, criminal acts occurred, but there will be no criminal investigation. The same day, the churches all announced they're going to cooperate with the TRC. Well, naturally, because they've been given carte blanche now, like they did in the residential school days, the government covering for the churches. I mean, how ridiculous. I mean, how criminal. That is criminal collusion in covering up a crime. Yet it's posing as this official government investigation. I mean, that gives you an example of how illegitimate it is.
I would forgive them if they would just admit what they did to us is genocide.
And the government has never, ever came up and acknowledged their mistake of a residential school. And the churches are hiding behind the laws, and I feel less cowardly.
The more I began to work with them, I had to understand what genocide really looks like up close, what it means to be at the receiving end of a campaign to exterminate you, what it means to be the survivors of mass murder. You go around with, you feel like you're going to die at any moment, you're going to be tortured at any moment again, so all you have to do is hide. You got to hide.
I still have nightmares about snakes and all the kind of things that happened to me in school, and very difficult, you know. Sometimes I tried ending my life many times because I just couldn't stand the pain that I was going through.
He said, you know what, sis? He says, I can't wait to get out of this hellhole. I'm going to tell everything. And then the phone went dead. People at resident at Cooper Island always listened to our phone calls and censored our letters back you know, coming in and going out. So I, you know, like I was afraid for him, but I didn't think it was going to be as bad as it was. It turned out as bad as it was. 2 days later, we got a phone call saying that he hung himself. He committed suicide. But I never, ever, ever believed in my heart that he'd ever do that. They had them walk through the gym while Richard was still hanging and told them that it could happen to them.
What are the chances of proceeding with a criminal trial?
We've tried that. There's a family whose daughter witnessed her sister get beaten to death by a matron in a United Church school in Edmonton in the 1960s. They tried to take her to court, and the United Church as a second party. Judge threw it out. He said, this is a matter for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The courts say it's up to the government. The government says, no, we're not going to do a criminal inquiry. So people are stuck in limbo. The courts are openly colluding in not looking into these murders.
One can only imagine what would happen if it were white children being treated this way in some other institution, how quickly they would be prosecuted and brought to justice.
There's two standards of justice for Native people and white people in Canada.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Amanda Bellerby, and my guest today is Kevin Annett. Talk a little bit about the settlement offer that's being made by the Canadian government.
The $10,000 was this thing the Assembly of First Nations agreed to. It's ludicrous, first of all. You know, in Los Angeles, the Catholic Church recently made settlement with people who survived sexual abuse by their priests and bishops. Everyone got $1.1 million. They never had to prove anything, never had to go to court. It was just part of the settlement. In Canada, you get $10,000, so you're worth 1% of a white person, first of all. Most of the people I know down here can't access the money because they can't prove they went to a school. They don't have access to those records. So that minority that do access the $10,000, they then have to sign a gag order whereby they will never sue the churches or government. Well, compensation doesn't negate legal action on these other crimes, and yet suddenly it does in Canada.
And how many people are going along with that?
Well, some people take it because they need the money. You know, down here, $10,000 is a lot for people, but it's not enough to get your life together. The week after the checks were issued, three people, I know, overdosed. They took the money and they drank themselves to death or overdosed on drugs. It's like putting a gun on a table. You hand somebody in a bad condition that amount of money and you know what's going to happen. I think it's calculated. They know very well what the impact is going to be.
We've lost thousands upon thousands of children through suicide, not natural death, suicide. We find them every day of the week. We find them down in the city of Vancouver. You know, the city of Vancouver is just a small part of what goes on across Canada and the United States, because we have a lot of our First Nations people dying on the streets of Seattle. Because before the Europeans landed, our people traveled back and forth, and so they had relatives down there. And so we had, like in Vancouver, for instance, you have between 45 to 60,000 Native people living in the city of Vancouver. And you're probably finding pretty close to 90% of them are dying on the streets, you know, of drug abuse, not alcohol, drug abuse. How do I know that? Because I sit on the board down there with a Native Liaison Society that's attached to the Vancouver City Police. And I asked the question one time, how many of our people die, or people die on the streets of Vancouver? He said, whatever you read on the paper, you can multiply that by 10 times. And the year before last, you had 365 deaths, so you could figure that out. And that's a direct impact of residential school.
A friend of ours, Sylvia Yellowhorse, from Alberta, she died because of alcohol poisoning. She drank so much. So I believe that she was one of the kids that was abused by one of the staff members or a few of the staff members. Oh, this really hurts.
Many of our women, young women especially, are going missing because now, after the residential school abuse and everything is over, they're treating our young women like they're disposable. Nobody seems to care when they do go missing. As far as they're concerned, it's just another dead Indian.
Right now, in the downtown east side, Aboriginal people are the ones that are getting HIV. They're the ones that are getting hepatitis C. We're suffering the most from this, and we just got to stop it somehow. It's the only way we can stop it is by trying to get people to care, right?
So what are your recommendations, Kevin Annett? What is it, besides the larger truths of out-and-out genocide, what would happen next?
Well, we'd have a war crimes tribunal in Canada, administered by agencies outside the country. You'd have the heads of the churches, the Prime Minister of Canada, Stephen Harper. You'd have them all on trial because they're the fiduciary officers of these institutions. They're liable because under the Nuremberg laws, any head of state or head of an organization is responsible for the acts of institutions that committed deliberate genocide. It might be a utopian ideal, but at least some process that is not based on the government and the system here in Canada, of first of all finding full disclosure, telling the full story, a process of repatriation of the remains of the kids who died, the creation of memorial sites, Aboriginal Holocaust museums, entering this information into the curriculum of the schools and the education system so we non-Native people can begin to learn. I mean, you know, at the Nuremberg trials, they relied on the testimony of 30 people to indict the Nazi regime. We have hundreds of people who can come forward now and indict the government and churches. It's not going to happen in a system when those institutions are still running the show. We've called for things like a boycott of the 2010 Olympics in British Columbia. We've started a movement actually in Europe where people are not buying Canadian goods. They've done it over the seals. You know, a little Native child is certainly as cute as a baby seal. Generations of children were murdered legally and are still unaccounted for.
If you had to do it all over again, Kevin, would you do it again?
Yes, absolutely, because I wouldn't have been able to live with myself if I had have known these things and done what I was told, which was to keep quiet about it.
Why don't Canadians have courage, Kevin? Why don't Canadians speak out? Why are things thrown at us that we just accept?
The Native people on the coast even have a name for whites, the Mamakni, the ghost people, the ones without substance. I didn't want to be a Mamakni anymore. I wanted to be a human being.
What did they see in us that we didn't see?
They saw what we had lost. You know what happened in Europe over centuries? Same kind of trauma they went in here. The religious wars, the famines, the Black Death, the persecutions, the torture, the witch hunts, the mass murder of millions of people, throwing my ancestors off their land. And so we're all trauma victims, you know, those of us who come over here. We not only haven't faced our trauma when we came here, but we had lost something.
Look what you've done to the First Nation people. You abused their bodies. You have raped the land. You have polluted the land. You have polluted the minds of the Native people, the kids. You've raped the kids. You killed the kids.
You look at Indigenous people and say, well, why would we despoil our river? Why would we grab more land than we need? Why would there be poor people in our midst and rich people? That doesn't make any sense. I mean, no society can survive living like that, and yet it's the virtue in our society to operate like that. So we're crazy. I mean, we have become completely insane. And it comes out of that, you know, that terrible alliance that happened when you had this notion that a religion called Christendom was superior to all others and had to conquer the world, combined with the vested interest of a merchant class that wanted to conquer the world for its own profit, armed with this religion. Krishnamurti, who was a Hindu writer, he said a beautiful thing, and that's why I think, I don't believe in religions, I believe the spirit is shared by people all over, but he said, God hides himself in the most broken ones among us, and God hides himself in the most broken parts of ourselves, hidden in there, but present, like a little seed. And I'd say that our worst experiences are a way to reveal that, and for us to find a new meaning and strength in our life, because when you lose everything for the right reason, for a just cause, or for people who can't fight for themselves, when you stand with them and lose everything, you gain everything.
Can you talk about the connection between genocide and ecocide?
I think it's fundamentally related. In an immediate historical sense, it was the desire to get the land that was responsible for this genocide. But it also came out of a whole attitude, of course, which a lot of people have talked about, and that is, you know, the rape of the earth and the rape of the innocent. It's an idea that's at the heart of Christendom, I think. And that is that the earth has fallen. The Judeo-Christian tradition really separated divinity from the earth. And by projecting it out into heaven, it made the earth into this barren, hostile world. It created this idea that the world is a thing to be feared, to be fought, to be conquered. And I think, you know, the whole mania of quote, development and the destruction of the earth comes from a Puritan idea in England, which was at the heart of the founding fathers in America and the people here. And that is the world is imperfect. And in the same way we have to, quote, develop the world and make it better, we had to develop the savage and make them better. And it comes out of the same core idea of, like, this dissatisfaction with us, this inability to see that the creation is beautiful and perfect as we are. We kind of take this warfare in ourselves and project it on other people and the land and destroy it in the process. The child is born corrupted and evil and must be disciplined, and their willfulness has to be crushed. It's this fear of the innocence in the child, and I think it's the same fear that culture has about the innocence of creation.
When the Lord your God brings you into the land you are entering to possess, and drives out before you many nations, and you have defeated them, then you must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them, and show them no mercy. Do not allow any of them to live. This is what you are to do to them. Break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, cut down their trees, and burn them in the fire. For you are a people chosen by the Lord over all others on the face of the earth.
There's areas of Canada where, in fact, the European settlers got along really well, and the Métis people are the outcome of that. My relatives, when we came from Ireland and Scotland and settled in the Red River settlement, actually got along really well with the native people, and they shared, I think, having been forced out of our land by the same empire, and Celtic traditions and spirituality. There's a real resonance between that and native spirituality in a lot of ways. But then you had the forces of empire coming along and the church showing up often and saying, you can't marry with these heathens. You can't have mixed families like this. You've got to separate. And it was that kind of religious thing that broke that up.
I think they feel a loss of it in themselves. Like John Trudell talks about, a genetic memory that European whites have of losing their connection to the land, that we are lonely for it ourselves.
I think that's very true. And it's certainly true in the case of my family. I mean, we were forced out of the Highlands of Scotland by the English, and we couldn't speak our language, we couldn't wear our traditional garb. We came here as untreated trauma victims. And so historically, when we talk about the healing process, it isn't fundamentally Native people who got to be healed, because they've in many ways kept rooted in who they are, the language, the land. We're the ones who are unrooted, and we're the ones who need the healing. We got to take a strong look at ourselves and what we're doing to the earth and to other people. And if we don't heal that, I mean, we're the problem. You know, I very much believe that our global culture, corporate capitalism, is heading over the brink. And unless we recover these values, they came from our own indigenous traditions of how to live in harmony with one another in the earth. And as I said in an article I wrote recently, you know, the word apology in English has two meanings. An apology can be an expression of regret. It can also be a disclaimer and a justification of oneself. You know, an apologetic is a way to defend one's own actions. So in this case, it's very much the issue that the government and the churches will be saying that, yes, it's unfortunate what happened, but we are not responsible. It was not intentional. We are not liable for it. And that's the legal purpose of an apology. And the proof is all there that it was intentional. And we have to be as accountable as the Nazis were in Nuremberg.
How can people stay in touch with the issue and help, especially in the next 6 months to a year, as this really important uncovering of the actual story goes forward?
Well, I'll be actually doing a speaking tour in the U.S. and in Europe in the summer and the fall. And contacting me at hiddenfromhistory@yahoo.ca, seeing our website at www.hiddenfromhistory.org, and seeing the film Unrepentant. I think it's the best educational tool we have, and I'd be happy to come and speak and work with anybody on this.
You can see the film at the website hiddenfromhistory.org. It's also up on Google Videos. This is Amanda Bellerby speaking to Kevin Annett in Vancouver, BC. For Flashpoints, Kevin, thank you very much.
Thank you.